My guest Joshua Hammer has been Newsweek's Jerusalem bureau chief since the fall of 2000. He's written a new book called A Season in Bethlehem, Unholy War in a Sacred Place. It's about Israel's invasion of the West Bank town of Bethlehem in April 2002. Bethlehem is the city in which it is believed Jesus was born. The final chapter is about the siege of the Church of the Nativity when Palestinian gunmen forced their way into the church, beginning a 39-day standoff with the Israeli troops that surrounded the church. Hammer was in a nearby hotel at the beginning of the siege. After it ended, he pieced together what happened by profiling several of the people who were there, including a Palestinian militant, an Israeli soldier, the governor of Bethlehem, and a priest. I asked Hammer why the Palestinian gunmen took over the Church of the Nativity.
Palestinian gunmen moved into the church because they believed, quite rightly, that it would offer them protection. I think they were totally stunned by the size of the and force of the Israeli invasion of the of Bethlehem, and they knew through experience, through history, that the Church of the Nativity has been there through the centuries as a place of refuge. Most recently, in the 1967 war, Palestinians took refuge there during the bombing, Jordanian and Israeli bombings that went on there. So it was always there. It was always in the back of their minds. And when the Israeli tanks and troops advanced down towards, basically chased the militants through the streets of the old city down to Manger Square in front of the Church of the Nativity, it was on everybody's mind. Go to the church. They shot the locks off the Franciscan monastery, entered, poured into the church. 250 of them went in there, and then waited to see how the Israelis would respond.
Is there a point of view that you were exposed to from the people who were at the Church of the Nativity during the siege that seemed incomprehensible to you before that you feel you understand better now as a result of this reporting?
Well, I think that I, in the course of reporting this book and in the course of being a reporter in the Middle East, went through the kind of experience that Father Parthenios, the Greek Orthodox priest in my book, underwent. He was a person who was viewed these Palestinian militants from a distance, was suspicious of them, didn't really know what they represented, tended to lump them all together, was frightened of them. In the course of being trapped with them over 39 days, he began to sympathize with their plight and their political views. Now, I am not saying that I particularly admired any of these people, but I went through a similar experience as Father Parthenios in getting to know these people as human beings and not just as these sort of cardboard, homicidal, killer, terrorist figures that are so easily caricatured, especially by the Israeli government.
What are some of the qualities that Father Parthenios or you found in the militant gunmen who took over the church that seemed more sympathetic?
One of the things that struck me about so many of these people was how jail had transformed them. Jail was a crucible that shaped their personalities. And I'm not talking about the Second Intifada. I'm talking about jail in the 1980s. Many of them, as kids, were throwing stones in the streets of Bethlehem during that First Intifada in the 1980s, were arrested at the age of 14, 15, 16, thrown into Israeli prisons, often tortured, certainly beaten, harshly interrogated, and made to languish in Israeli jails for years. You could draw a 3-year or 4-year prison sentence for throwing a rock back in those days. What struck me most is how important that experience was in shaping the mentality, in shaping the animosity, in shaping the militancy that drives so many of these young men 10, 12, 14 years later.
One of the people you profiled was one of the militants behind the siege, and that was Ibrahim Abayat, a Fatah guerrilla leader. Tell us something about him and his reasons for being part of that siege.
Well, Abayat and his whole extended family, the Abayats, are a fascinating group in Bethlehem. They come out of a nomadic background, from the Judean wilderness near the Dead Sea. They are traditionally the car thieves, arms dealers, all around tough guys of Bethlehem. They basically formed the bedrock of the armed groups in Bethlehem when the Intifada began. He was a very interesting character because he was notorious before, well before the Intifada began. He carried out the first honor killing, so-called honor killing in the region in a generation. He and his first cousin found out that their first cousin, a woman, had been allegedly carrying out an extramarital affair, kidnapped both her and her alleged lover, and executed them both. There was a big celebrated trial. He was found guilty. His clansmen went on a rampage through the streets of Bethlehem, burning houses, burning cars, and a guy very much whose life was very much embedded in these Muslim Bedouin traditions that came out in this violent way. So by the time the Intifada began, he was well known as a notorious character in the city, and he lived up to that reputation.
How did he behave inside during the siege?
Ibrahim Ebayat was a hot-tempered, unpredictable, dangerous character. Inside, he was jumpy. He contemplated a bloody breakout, just storming out through the door of humility and most likely being killed. He intimidated people. Anybody who was thinking about trying to leave, he would call a collaborator, threaten them explicitly with death. He was one of the figures who kept people in line. Basically, he was the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades.
You describe him toward the end of the siege, and you write, plagued by migraines, hungry and weak, gone was the confidence of the gunman who had once strutted around Bethlehem, who had vowed to go out either a winner or a martyr. Now he was feebly pleading for exile. How was he changed, do you think, during the course of that long siege? And how did it affect
many, I won't say all, but many of these militants, with 2020 hindsight, one sees that so much of what they did was posturing, that essentially they were cowards. Ibrahim Ebayat took the easy way out, essentially. He surrendered. At the end, he realized he was up against a very powerful force, that his options were accept exile or die, and he meekly accepted exile. So he was a very changed, humbled figure by the end of it.
What is his reputation now among other militants?
It's hard to say, because the militant groups of Bethlehem have pretty much been decimated. I think he's forgotten, and I think it. I visited him in Spain several months after the siege was over, and he was dispatched to exile, and it killed him. I think it just crushed him psychologically to know that he was quickly being forgotten.
One of the people who you write about during the siege is one of your neighbors, who is an Israeli who was actually born in Southern California and immigrated to Jerusalem in 1973 after the Yom Kippur War. He was a reservist who was called to active duty during the siege. 15 young soldiers under his command. What were some of his concerns during the siege of Bethlehem?
I think first and foremost, it was his concern for the life of the young men under his command. He was a 32-year-old reservist, so he was concerned going in the course of those long hours before the battle actually began, rumbling in his armored personnel carrier into Bethlehem in the darkness, that these militants were going to put up a real fight, and there would likely be some death among the young men that he was leading into battle, and that he would possibly be killed himself. He was very, very conflicted about the whole thing. As I write in the book, he was the son of a leader, one of the leaders of the Peace Now movement, had grown up in this very, very left-wing home. Now he was riding in an armored personnel carrier, leading men into battle against these Palestinians whom he had always sympathized with. So he was a very conflicted person.
And did he stay conflicted after the siege was over?
Well, Mike Aviad went through the conversion process that so many Israelis had gone through over the last couple of years, which is definitely drifted more and more towards the right. Didn't vote for Ariel Sharon in 2001, the first election, but really viewed Arafat as a terrorist and was fully supportive of Ariel Sharon's decision to send invade the West Bank in a massive way. By the end of the siege, I think he came out of it feeling, I don't know if this is going to achieve anything ultimately. I'm not sure. We're not going to stamp out this rebellion. We're not going to stamp out this uprising, but we have to do something.
Your new book is about the siege of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem and about the Israeli incursion into Bethlehem. What are some of the different lessons that you think Israelis, particularly Israelis in the government and the cabinet, took away from that incursion into Bethlehem? I imagine different people have taken different messages.
Well, I would say that it breaks down into two camps, and the two camps are still warring today.
Mm-hmm.
One camp would say that the Bethlehem operation exemplified how you can, in fact, subdue terror with military force and military force alone. Since the invasion of Bethlehem, the amount of violence that's been coming out of that particular area, in fact, the entire West Bank has dropped dramatically. There's no question that there have been many fewer suicide bombings, many few sniper attacks, attacks on soldiers. The violence has dropped dramatically in that year and a half. On the other hand, there would be others who took away from the invasion of Bethlehem and the invasion of the West Bank the very opposite lesson. As we saw only a couple of weeks ago, in this heavily locked down West Bank where it's very difficult to move from town to town, even outside your own village, Hamas was able to get two suicide bombers across the Green Line dividing Israel from the West Bank, blow themselves up in both Tel Aviv and Jerusalem in a cafe three blocks from my house, and cause 15, 16 deaths. So they would say, look, you've entered the West Bank, you've locked it down, you're creating all of this additional misery and hatred, and they're still getting through. So these two sides are still arguing, and there isn't a resolution.
It was the hope of some people within the Bush administration that war in Iraq would lead to a peace in the Middle East, you know, through a revival of the roadmap to peace. The roadmap is now off the table. Right now, how does it look like the war in Iraq has affected the possibility of a Middle East peace?
Well, look, I never saw the connection, and a lot of my colleagues and a lot of the people I talked to there always thought that was specious. What was the link between Iraq and the Palestinians? I mean, there was a link, direct link. Okay, Saddam was writing out checks, $25,000 here and there to the families of suicide bombers. He expressed his support for the Palestinian cause. I never saw the link. I see the Palestinian-Israeli dynamic as being unique, as being very independent from what goes on 500 miles away in Iraq. And I don't think, and I never did think, and I still don't think, that the dynamic of Iraq will in any way affect this sort of cycle of revenge and retaliation and hatred that continues to defeat any attempts to make a peace deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I just don't see the link.
Your previous book, Chosen by God, was a book about your brother who became a Hasidic Jew and is now living in Israel. Where is he living?
No, he's actually living in Muncie, New York, 30 miles north of New York. It began in Israel, his conversion, so to speak, if you can refer to a Jew becoming an extremely religious Jew, a conversion. Took place in Israel about 22 years ago, but he quickly moved to New York and found his way into a community in north of New York City. A mixed community, modern Orthodox, ultra Orthodox, and Hasidim.
Mm-hmm. I know he's your brother, but would you consider him an extremist or?
Yes, I would consider him an extremist. He wouldn't consider himself an extremist. But I would think even within the spectrum of ultra-Orthodoxy, he would be at the extreme end of it. For instance, he's one of those ultra-Orthodox Jews who believes that the state of Israel has no right to exist until the Messiah comes, which is a fairly fringe position, and still appears to fervently believe that. It's one of the reasons that he's never gone back to Israel.
Do you think that you try to be any more open-minded in your ability to kind of understand the acts of political or religious extremists because someone in your family has become so extreme?
I don't know if I'm more tolerant or accepting of it. I'm more inclined to understand everything I can about it. I was drawn in my book, Chosen by God, to go back to my own family and dig up history and find out what are the psychological factors that drive somebody to embrace Hasidic Judaism from a totally secular, almost atheistic background, to make that kind of leap. So in the same way, I suppose I was driven to explore, for instance, what would make an 18-year-old girl somebody, you know, pretty much the same age as my brother was when he made his conversion, to go from being a promising student in Bethlehem, looking forward to a college career, as my brother was, who was engaged to be married and lived a very traditional life, was swept up in the fervor surrounding her, and strapped on a suicide belt and blew herself up at the age of 18 and killed two people in March 2002. Now, I am, of course, I'm not equating my brother's choice in any way with suicide bombers in Palestine. I'm just saying these are two manifestations of an extreme belief and a willingness to surrender completely to that belief, sometimes with violent consequences. So, yeah, it's intriguing to me. I would say perhaps that my experience with my brother led me toward this path, inevitably toward this path.
Do you think that being Jewish affects your coverage of the Middle East?
I hope it doesn't. I think it enrages certain people within the Israeli government and certain Israelis that I meet who believe that there should be a natural embrace of Israel, and a natural embrace of everything it does, and an identification with the state of siege that it finds itself in, and that any defense whatsoever of the Palestinians or any attempt to sort of explain, humanize these people is somehow defines one as a self-hating Jew and makes one suspect. I think there's a good deal. I've heard that a lot. Even a couple of weeks ago, or last week when I was on my book tour, I was accused of, a woman got up and called me traitor. But I try not to let that bother me. I do believe in the state of Israel, have a natural sympathy for the state of Israel, but I think there's a huge difference between having sympathy and belief, firm belief in the state of Israel, and blindly endorsing some of the excesses, some of the policies that I believe this current Israeli government is pursuing in the name of making peace, in the name of providing security to its people. I don't think it's working. I think it's often counterproductive. I think it's causing an awful lot of misery. And I'm aware when I say these things that I'm opening myself up to intense criticism. But I don't think of myself, I suppose, as a Jew first. I think of myself as a journalist.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Joshua Hammer is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for Newsweek. His new book is called A Season in Bethlehem.